Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, creating laundry rooms with improved storage, workspace, and everyday function for one of the home's most used spaces. Inspiration at callmosby.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. In 1977, the late Ray Hartman founded the Riverfront Times. It was meant to be a neighborhood publication, but gained a following and reputation as an indispensable source of news and information about alternative culture in St. Louis. It served as such for 45 years until 2024, when the newspaper was sold to private buyers and unexpectedly and abruptly closed. The sale was a major blow. Journalists and staffers at the RFT lost their jobs. St. Louisans lost a beloved alt-weekly that covered stories that larger media outlets didn't or often wouldn't take up. And the St. Louis region as a whole was about to lose decades of reporting by the Riverfront Times because there was no formal archive. That is, until Washington University Libraries stepped in. With quick planning and collaboration, WashU librarians were able to collect volumes of RFT editions as the newspaper closed its doors. Former editor-in-chief Sarah Fenske shared her thoughts on the importance of archiving the RFT.
I think it is a preservation of St. Louis history, and I think we saw that firsthand after Ray Hartman was unfortunately taken too young. There were people reaching out to me going, hey, I'm trying to look up this thing. Can you tell me where I can find the RFT archive? And I had to say, you can't really find this online right now. You have to contact WashU Libraries. And it was actually very soon after that that they were able to announce that, yes, this is now available. It is open. Researchers can come in and look through these. But had they not done that, that entire, I think, 1977 through 1998 would have been gone for good. And I think there's even things after that that have been able to be preserved due to the Wayback Machine. But because of the work of those people, even the newer stuff that has now been taken down from the RFT's website, that would have also been gone. It would have been like the paper didn't even exist.
Joining me in studio to discuss her work to ensure people today and in the future know the Riverfront Times existed indeed and thrived is Miranda Rechtenwald, curator of local history in the Department of Special Collections at Washington University Libraries. Miranda, welcome back to St. Louis on the Air.
It's great to be back, Elaine. Thank you.
Let's start with your own relationship with RFT. You were born and raised here. You grew up in St. Louis. What are your memories of that publication?
So the RFT, I think, like many people, was always around. There was free copies. You would read it whenever you went to a coffee shop. And also, it was just a great place to see who were the bands coming to town, what was the new restaurant, just really very hyper-local news and just such a fixture of St. Louis.
So you and your colleagues, you've done as much work as you can to gather the Riverfront Times, to archive. You have your own, personal relationship, as you've just described. But when was it that you and your team together first determined that the RFT needed to be preserved?
Well, previously I had worked to locate older issues from the 1980s and 90s of the RFT for other research projects, for exhibitions. It was then that I had learned that really the most complete archive was one maintained by the RFT themselves, that the journalist used to go back to for previous articles. And I had actually gone to the RFT offices years before to consult some of them. And at the time, I had said, this is, such an amazing set of materials. And they said, yes, we use it all the time, which is wonderful. And that's what we want to see happen with materials. Mm-hmm. But I knew it was so important that when I heard that the offices were closing, I had to know what was going to happen and make sure that really great resource was saved somewhere.
Mm-hmm. How soon after the news of the RFTs being sold and shut down did you spring into action
Well, archives don't usually happen really fast. I will say this was an unusual case, but it was the same day that I saw the news report go out that I emailed the editor, who was Sarah Fenske at the time, and said, just what do you know what's happening with this? You know, what can I do to help? And so it was really like a sort of 48-hour kind of turnaround that we put that plan in place.
Were there conversations with WashU libraries that made it possible for you to act, you know, in that fashion day of?
So as I said, this is pretty unusual. But when there is a case of something that would be lost because just time constraints, my department head and my administration was very supportive when I said, I want to go look at this. I might be bringing back a lot of stuff. I'm not sure how much it's going to be, but they were very supportive and said, you know, what could they do to help? So,
do you have a big vehicle?
So I have a pretty standard SUV, but I put out a call to all of my colleagues. This occasionally happens where we'll say we sort of have an emergency plea. And two of my colleagues said, yep, they could come help. And so we got it all into three vehicles.
Okay. So there's a bit of a caravan. What did the process look like? I mean, did it begin with just moving boxes of things?
So obviously we needed to get official permission for these things to be donated. And so the last business manager of the RFT, who was in charge of closing everything down, was able to go over the legal paperwork with me to do the donation so that it could be donated. And then it was a process of, yes, physically getting them moved out of the building, packed in boxes, and moved to our storage facility that we have for the libraries. And then from that point, it has been a longer, slower process to go through and actually put them into even just date order, because while they came in big bound volumes, we packed them so quickly that 40 years of history wasn't in any order. So it took a while to get them put back into date order so we could make them usable.
Okay. Getting that permission, you know, what does that entail? You know, are you signing documents, you know, that agree to very specific terms?
So that is part of what we do as a professional institutional archive, is we make sure that everything is documented with a legal deed of gift. And that deed of gift does outline all the terms, both for physical ownership, intellectual ownership, communication. And so that's something we do on a regular basis. So I did have those forms available because we do that on a regular basis. And in this case, we were able to fortunately do it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand, the work that you've done has involved several other defunct local publications. What have you learned from working on those kinds of archives that informed, you know, the way that you were able to start the archiving of the RFT?
Well, something like a newspaper especially, you know, was never really designed to last. It was on paper, and it was of the moment, and then it was passed. So basically, it's a matter of doing what we can. All of the history that we could save of a newspaper is good. And part of that is knowing where else it's saved. So knowing that there were not other libraries that had already been collecting the RFT, and they had, but in bits and pieces, so not a complete set, meant that more priority could go to this.
Mm-hmm. Did you acquire then some things from other libraries informally?
No, not so much other libraries informally, just to know that, like, for instance, if I had known that the State Historical Society already had a really big collection of the RFT, then I would have known, oh, I just need to make sure we get, like, the latest issues or something, rather than everything being important.
Yeah. So far we've been talking, in some sense, at least to me, about the physical papers. But there's what the RFT meant and what it did. And our executive producer, Alex Hoyer, caught up with former Riverfront Times editor-in-chief Sarah Fenske to ask what she considers to be RFT's place in the local news and publication landscape. And here's what Sarah had to say.
I think the big thing about the RFT is we stood up for the little guy. You know, everybody else wants to be a mouthpiece for the people who are in power, because that's the easier thing when you're a journalist. It's where you can often find really easy and important stories. And I think the RFT was like, no, we are the voice of the people in many ways. And we're there to defend the little guy. We're there to push back on authority. It was that sort of contrarian attitude that I think made the RFT so unique throughout its very long run.
And when you consider that run, what would you say are the contributions of it advancing St. Louis culture and history?
Oh, boy. I'm sure you would hear from people who would say it did just the opposite. It did this tacky and rude publication that showed St. Louis off to be worse than it was. But I think, you know, we brought sort of a good humor to our coverage. And I think that's important. If a city can't kind of laugh at its own foibles, what are we even doing? I think we also did some deep investigative work. There were stories that just took many words and longer investigations to get to the bottom of. And we felt very strongly that that was worth doing, even though it comes at a cost to let reporters go deep down that rabbit hole. And I think also the cultural coverage. Again, we weren't just covering the St. Louis Symphony Opera Theater of St. Louis. We were there covering people who were just getting started.
That was Sarah Fenske, former editor-in-chief at the Riverfront Times. What comes to mind hearing all of that, Miranda?
Oh, absolutely. That's history that's of everyday people. And that could be a single family that was facing some fight with City Hall or emerging ecological issue that neighborhoods were concerned about and really wanting to know and more information. So really that very often overlooked story. But historically, looking back, that's what really gives us the truer picture of what the past was like. So archiving that really matters in my mind.
Was there anything in particular that made you feel that WashU Libraries was the right place for this archive?
Well, we do have experience working with other publications. So you mentioned that I did have that experience. So one of the other publications that we've worked with is the St. Louis Evening Whirl. The issues that survived from that publication had come to us through some connections through actually the English faculty. Mm-hmm. But I'll be honest, I was mostly just concerned that it be preserved. And if it was already promised and preserved and going to another library, then that was going to be equally good to me. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make sure it was preserved somewhere.
We're speaking today with Miranda Rechtenwald. She's the curator of local history in the Department of Special Collections at Washington University Libraries. And we're discussing the archive of the Riverfront Times. There are also, you know, those cultural aspects of what the RFT covered. You know, Sarah Fenske mentioned that. And even for me, as a new transplant about 12 years ago, I was certainly seeing that in the paper, which, you know, as you mentioned, you saw in coffee shops and that sort of thing. That's where I picked it up as well. What have you found in the RFT that captures cultural aspects of St. Louis, maybe of certain communities that really just cannot be found elsewhere?
Absolutely. There's definitely a lot of LGBTQ history moments, whether that's a big story covering things about an anti-discrimination lawsuit or the emergence of efforts in the 1980s and 90s against HIV/AIDS. But also just minor moments of a restaurant that didn't last very long, but their advertisement is in the RFT, or alternative music, absolutely. Before things become big and recognized and worth documenting, they still certainly happen. Mm-hmm. So those are all moments in just everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Other than articles themselves from the RFT, now, what else gets preserved, Miranda, when you are archiving a publication like the Riverfront Times, which had a lot in it?
So the advertisements are certainly of interest to people looking back at history. to see what was being archived. I've already had a couple of researchers come in who were looking at when did certain bands perform, and they could tell from the advertisements just saying when their shows were happening, they could track that information down. Also, the supplementary things that the RFT put out. So they put out restaurant guides, music guides that went even deeper into those subjects. And so as much of that as possible, we've also been trying to archive.
Mm-hmm. And how is it these things that researchers come to find, how are they useful in the present and also in the future?
In really a lot of ways. It could be just personal history. So in that case, it was kind of like a reunion group of musicians, and he was trying to figure out when they would have gone as a group of friends to see different bands. And he's like, nobody's memory remembers 1986 very well, so we need to look that up. But also to look for students and scholars who are looking at our city's history, you know, this gives a much fuller picture.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about advertisements because they have a way of reflecting, you know, the language of a time, some of the prevailing notions about things. Are there any ads in particular that stand out as being maybe ones that would really only show up in a publication like the RFT or...
Well, definitely music, particularly entertainment. There's also, for people who are studying the larger scope of national history in terms of advertisements, this is St. Louis's aspect of what's known as the sort of back page advertisements, which are of a more sexual nature for the sex industry. And that leads into some current national topics about who has the right to censor what. So that's sort of an interesting aspect in that all alt-weeklies sort of carried that. But the other thing is also employment, and then they had personal ads for a while. So all of those give a really rich history.
Mm-hmm. The RFT, as we mentioned in the introduction, it was founded in 1977, and then it came to an end effectively in 2024. So that is 47 years of local history and culture, where you're describing things being out of order. When you first were looking at these boxes of things, it sort of made my head spin. What are the challenges that you and your team face in archiving material from such a large chunk of time? Or, I mean, relatively speaking, is that really so long?
Well, it is a significant amount of time. That's almost 50 years. So that's a very broad range, especially spanning through the 20th century. As technology is changing, you know, when the RFT starts, there's not even the concept of a web page. So digital content wasn't even conceived of. So there's definitely an evolution of communication there. Mm-hmm. But just in terms of the practicalities, what we try to do in the archives is work to make things stay safe, but also make them usable. So we try to organize and put things, make them available. We realize coming to campus isn't always the easiest, mm-hmm. but we do what we can to remove barriers, help people know upfront what we do have, make sure that if they do want to come to campus, it's worth their time, and they can really put that time to effort to sit down with the volumes and look through it and get what they need.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a long undertaking, mostly because the volumes are heavy. They're big newspapers, and you don't think of a newspaper as being heavy, but when you stack up a quarter or a half of a year of them, they get pretty heavy. So that's another part of it, is just the logistics. So I worked with our team to really figure out even just what shelves and storage they could go on so that we could easily get them on and off of the shelves safely when people ask to use them.
Mm-hmm. When folks found out that WashU Libraries was now handling this archive, did you get people contacting you about stuff they wanted to give you that do not belong in the particular archive that you're working with?
Sure, that happens all the time. And with RFT, we haven't had a lot of people reaching out too much, but we certainly do get people who reach out. And if it is not a good fit for us, we do our best to find a way to connect them with a library and archive that would be a better fit.
Mm-hmm. Riverfront Times former editor-in-chief Sarah Fenske, she has expressed her gratitude to WashU Libraries for taking on the archiving of the RFT. And there are also several editions of the paper that have yet to be archived, and up until recently, that included the very first issue of the Riverfront Times. Here is Sarah's account of inadvertently helping find and archive lost copies of the RFT.
So after Ray passed away, his lawyer reached out to me and said, do you know anyone who'd want this? Because I just opened the garage door to Ray's house and there's a lot of old newspapers there. And I was like, yeah, well, WashU Library. So, and I did say, I'm like, there's the first issue is missing. Nobody has seen this issue since 1977. Apparently it was in Ray's hoarder garage. So that is amazing. So that means there will now be I think there's actually a couple other now missing issues, but having that first issue is huge.
Now, neither Sarah nor Ray Hartman's lawyer knew that they had found the first edition of the RFT at that moment. But that's a huge find, right?
It was a moment of celebration. So I was able to go, and with the help of Ray's family and friends who were pulling things out of his garage, which I will say was clean and dry and organized, not so organized, but at least in tote boxes. Mm-hmm. But it did take going through a lot of them. When the first issue was found, there was a cheer that went up.
Yeah.
And we did also find there was about half of 1990 that wasn't at the RFT offices, and we did find those issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a full run now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interacting with Ray's family, you know, in such a moment of just, you know, dealing with the reality that they've lost the husband, the father, what was that interaction like? And was there something about being there as someone archiving so much of his life's work, you know, that stayed with you?
It does. It's one of the really bittersweet, both sad and touching parts of working as an archivist, is I often only meet people after they have passed away. So I'm meeting their family, and it is definitely something I'm very cognizant of, that what we want to do is preserve history and we want to honor their legacy, but I'm also not there to dictate, you know, their timeline and how soon they want to make things happen. Not everybody is always ready to let go of things. So it's always a discussion and a process. But I was very honored to be able to be there and meet some of his family. His journalism colleagues really stepped up and came and helped just sift through boxes. And we found there was actually an earlier publication the year before Riverfront Times that Ray had tried to start and had done for, I think, not quite a year. And so we were able to archive those copies as well of mm-hmm. that sort of predecessor publication.
Yeah.
But the family, it was really great to work with them and their friends. And it's always a discussion, absolutely an emotional time.
Yeah. Well, as we were listening to Sarah Fenske speak there, you had your eyes closed. You were nodding your head. I can imagine you were thinking back to what it was like to go into that garage. And I think, you know, so much of what people have in their homes, it is valuable history. You know, how much of that history ends up being archived, just generally speaking, all the stuff that sits at home?
Sure. Well, obviously, we couldn't, as a society, save everything that was ever produced, or we would be buried under that content. I've generally found people often do really well instinctively thinking these are important things. Now, it's not always, but at least enough to save them. And as they become less and less commonly around, that someone says, oh, maybe these photos or these diaries, I should talk to someone about this. So absolutely, if WashU's libraries aren't the right place and somebody reaches out, I absolutely try to connect them with the Missouri Historical Society or a different institution that is going to be, when we say the right place, I think of that as the place where they can be both best cared for and also used and known and appreciated, because just putting something in a box and saving it and no one ever seeing it is not really an archive. That's just something in storage. Mm-hmm. So we really want them to be things that can be used.
Mm-hmm. Who has access to these archives, Miranda? And would you like for more of the public to come and experience them?
So every archive has different rules, of course. At WashU Libraries, we are open to the public. We have no requirements beyond asking that people make an appointment for in-person visits, just because we have limited space and our staff retrieves everything out of storage. So we just want to make sure that if you come into the archives that we're not making you wait around for hours. That's not good. Okay. But we're open to everyone. And the only requirement is that we just ask that you sign a form that says you understand rules, like you're not going to spill food on them, and you'll ask if there's any copyright questions and things like that. But otherwise, we're open to everyone. And we certainly have a good number of people come in, and we'd love to have more.
Mm-hmm. Miranda Rechtenwald is the curator of local history in the Department of Special Collections at Washington University Libraries. Miranda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This episode was produced by Danny Wissentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
Hi, I'm Laura Hamden, and my colleague Jessica Rogan and I are your daily hosts of the Gateway Newsletter. We meet with the editors in the STLPR newsroom every weekday to bring you the top local stories of the day in a quick and easy 6-minute read by 6 a.m. In an age of overwhelm, it's a refreshing, thoughtful take on the news day, if we do say so ourselves. Fine-tune your daily news habit with the Gateway Newsletter. Subscribe at stlpr.org/gateway.